So on the Arba Kosos, you have an idea that Rabbi Yisrael Reisman is quoting here from the Chida. And I wasn't able to get, this is Rabbi Yisrael Reisman's idea, it's not his idea, it's Chida's idea, but it seems that other people, I wasn't able to get copies of other ideas on this concept, but that they explain it more in depth. And he writes that we have what's known as the Arba Galuyos. The Arba Galuyos refers to the four different types of exiles. Four different type of exiles we have in Daniel's dreams. We have the concept of Babel, Paros and Madai, Yavon, Edom. Medrash goes on to discuss the different types of Galuyos, different types of exiles that exist. So he asks this question, why is it that we have Galus Mitzrayim? The idea that we were in Egypt, that's like the Galus. So why isn't that one mentioned? When Daniel has his dream, he mentioned four, but he just skipped out on the whole big one that we have Mitzrayim. Why is it not even counted? So he writes, or he writes, I really don't understand the question. You know, Daniel had a dream about what was going to happen in the future, and he already passed Mitzrayim. But I think he says the question is, why in general we reference the Jewish people suffering, we don't reference the first exile of Mitzrayim. We only reference all subsequent exiles. So before we go forward on this, we have the general idea that the Galus Mitzrayim, the exile of Mitzrayim, and everything we went through over there was, in fact, the we'll call it the prototype of exile, and everything else that comes after is really just the suffering from that. That's the general answer usually given. But here he explains is that Galus Mitzrayim actually has in it Maisa Avot Simon Labanim, Maisa Avot Simon Labanim, which means that everything that our forefathers went through are actually going to then become duplicated. And what that means is, even though Mitzrayim is the prototype of all Galuyot, nonetheless, the four that you're going to have are actually going to be represented what precedes it. Which means the four cups of wine that we're going to be drinking are going to be represented by these four exiles, which come after Mitzrayim. Nonetheless, these four exiles, which are the four cups, are actually going to be based on the four galuyot, which comes after Mitzrayim. Okay, get this? Which means, in a simple way to read it, we went through Egypt, and now we have four cups. Why do you have four cups? You have four cups of the future exiles after Egypt. Where did those come from? Those actually come from the story of Yosef and his brothers. That's where those actually come from. So we'll throw in this idea, and we'll explain this idea a little bit better in a moment. So it says Rabbi Yisrael Reisman, I believe this idea comes from the Chida in his Haggadah, Simchas HaRegel. Klal Yisrael went down to Mitzrayim four times. That is, first, the 10 Shvatim went down because Yesherer b'Mitzrayim, there was food there. They went to Mitzrayim to get food. Then they went down a second time when they went with Binyamin. They went the third time when the 70 Shivim Nefesh, 70 people went down to Mitzrayim. Then they went down a fourth time in Parshas Vayechi. After they buried Yaakov Avinu, they then came back to Mitzrayim. Okay? Those four trips from Eretz Yisrael to Mitzrayim are the Maisa Avot Simon Labanim of the four Galiot that the Jewish people are going to experience after Mitzrayim. Of course, we all understand the fourth time they went, they had buried Yaakov Avinu, and they came back, and this was the darkest of the Galiot, the longest. It was a period that would lead to Shibud Mitzrayim, and certainly this appropriate remnants to the Galus in which we are suffering today. So, again, try to see if you can jump out of linear time. Because if you're stuck in linear time, you're going to get stuck. Why? Because you say, well, the things that happened to the Avos, that led them into Mitzrayim. But that's not what he's saying here. He's saying that there's Mitzrayim, and then there's Maisa Avot. Maisa Avot, which came before Mitzrayim, are actually going to be represented by everything that happens after Mitzrayim. And therefore he says that, he doesn't say this line, but someone else told me today, that in fact, the longest galut that they went through was the last one when they stayed in Mitzrayim. That is a reference to Galus of Edom. That's the Galus that we live in today, which is the longest of the Galuyot. So the four exiles, the fourth being the longest, is actually the Galus of Edom, the last one. So now he explains one piece of this, that's all I have. I don't have further than that. What's beautiful is that the second time they go down, this is the key, like if you were to just highlight that paragraph. The second time they go down, when they go down with Binyamin, we find that there are many acts that happen that fit well to be a remez in the second exile. The second exile is the Galus of Paras u'Madai, and it was the easiest of the four exiles the Jewish people went through. The Nes Purim takes place there. indeed we find in the Pasuk that says that when they went down with Binyamin, they all had a meal together with Yosef. And the Pasuk says, Vayishtu Vayishkuru Imo. They drank together. What is that a remez to? A remez to Achashverosh's party, that they went and drank together. When they go down the second time, we find that they drink, and some of them became drunk, Vayishkuru Imo. Okay? That was with Achashverosh's party. We find also later on, it says that Binyamin is given 5 garments, five garments. Rashi, or actually the Gemara in Megillah, says this is a remez to Mordechai, who would go with his 5 garments as found in Esther. Mordechai yatzam lefnei melech belavush malchus tchilas v'chor atar zav v'gedola. Okay, so he went down. He went down with 5 different types of clothing. Those are the 5 clothing that Binyamin was given over by Yosef. All of this is happening in the second time that they actually go down, because that experience is going to be the story that's going to happen during the future of Paros and Mada. Again, it's a sign of the second exile. The Pella, what the amazing thing is over here is that they saw in Yosef's behavior his Mitzrayim. Whatever Yosef was doing, this experience is actually going to be what the other nations are going to do. Therefore, it fits well that the 4 Galuyos or Galusin or Marumas here are hinted here, so it's actually 1 Galus here, plus the 4, which would come later, which is the 4 trips down to Mitzrayim. So again, Mitzrayim is the ultimate of all exiles. These 4 are going to come subsequently after, but it's all coming from myself, a similar bum, which actually came before that. Okay, going on, number 2. I would take questions on it, but I'm really not, because I see some of your blank faces. So I'm just going to go forward. Yeah? You'll read it together yourself. Again, you have to really understand what's going on in this one. It's a very deep stuff. Next, this one might be a little bit easier for you. Okay, the 4 cups. Yeah, the 4 cups. The Vilna Gaon. Would you like a drink? The Vilna Gaon explains that Would you like a drink?
Would you?
Okay. The Vilna Gaon explains that the 4 cups that we have relate to different worlds that Hashem created. These worlds are best understood on some linear time frame. Olam Hazeh, Yimei Mashiach, Tchias HaMesim, and Olam Haba. Okay, these are the 4 cups. The first cup is equated to Olam Hazeh. In this world, our goal is to sanctify ourselves in this world of physicality. This is Kiddush that we recite in the first cup. The second cup is related to the days of Mashiach, during the time when total clarity be found. We will still be speaking of the redemption of Egypt. That second cup that we have is Asher Ga'alnu, Begalus Avoseinu. That's the cup that you're saying the bracha on for Magid, right? So that's also going to be talking about Mashiach, and Hashem is going to redeem us. The third cup is related to the resurrection of the dead. Since Berkas HaMazon is recited on a cup of wine, and its main purpose is for a person to pray for his food, so too this is like resurrection, when the meal for the righteous will take place on what's known as Sudat Leviathan, Sudat Leviathan. Okay, the meal of that huge fish. Obviously, this is spiritual ideas in expressed in physical forms, but it's referring to the end of days, about related to resurrection of the dead. The fourth cup relates to the world to come. It's for this reason we recite Hal HaGadol on this cup. This Hal HaGadol speaks about a time when all good is palpable and experienced by all those who are there. What is Hal HaGadol? Anyone know what Hal HaGadol is?
Isn't it complete
halal? What is that? There's 2 halals that we have. We have Halal HaMitzri, which is the one we recite on Rosh Chodesh and every Chag. That's called Halal HaMitzri, and that's referring to Betzei Tisrael Mimitzrayim, all those things there. Halal HaGadol is a reference to Hodel Hashem Kitov Kilom Chazdo, the different, whatever it has there. Hodel Hashem Kitov Kilom Chazdo, Hodel Hashem Kitov, each one is a different line. Lo Sein Eflos Gadol Zol Kilom Chazdo, Kilom Chazdo. That's actually a reference to that of Halal, and that's why we say it in that last cup. So again, when you are going to be thinking about the 4 cups, you're going to be thinking at each one, now I'm going through the element of sanctifying Olam Hazeh. Now I'm making a bracha with the opportunity to be able to receive Mashiach. And then I'm going to get the next one, the opportunity for Tchias HaMesim, where everything is returning. Everything's going to be good. And the last cup that you have, which is going to go after, it's going to go on Nirtza, whatever it's going on, I'm sorry, it's before Nirtza, it's going to go on that halal level, it's this experience, that you have when everything is going to be good. You will receive and experience all good things. Whereas the classical interpretation of the four cups allows us to see the process of redemption of individual events in our lives, our physical lives, the Vilna Gaon's approach is a big macro view of what it's actually all about. Really, when you sit down to the Seder, the appropriate ways that you should be sitting down every year is really just getting a bird's eye view of the whole earth and all of what's going on in the world. It's not just something that's happening right now. With the Vilna Gaon's explanation, each of the cups may relate to a different experience or time frames, but what's clear is that they relate to a bigger picture of many snapshots taken throughout time. This gets us to think about life experiences and wonder which of those experiences paint the masterpiece of what makes our snapshots into our overall life. Okay, so again, it's a question you can ask at the Seder, is really understanding this concept that as you go through your Seder, you think it's just a meal or an event. It's about experiencing the totality of life. And you can ask people that particular question. Can you think of a particular time in your life when you really felt that experience of exile, that experience of redemption, or where you felt that you did something to cause an element of change, a spiritual change in your life or in somebody else's life? And you can see that people's lives are go through this experience of galus to ge'ula. You can ask that question at your Seder, how people can actually relate to different events in their life and how they can see the change of certain things. Next, Karpas. The Maharil explains, I can't believe I never saw this before. I always just assumed like everybody knew this. I never knew this before. Maybe you did. Again, so far, we're still working on our 10 to 20%. Maharil says, it is a hint to Samach Perach. The word Karpas, we arrange the letters, it's Samach Perach, which we might be familiar with, which is Shishim Ribu, 600,000, who had Perach, Avodat Perach, which was backbreaking labor. So that's a famous one that people speak about, is Karpas, we're eating it, is a reference to Samach Perach. Okay? Always wanted that question anyway, like, why here? Why is it when I take a potato, or your Sephardi, you probably take a celery, right? Why is it when I stick it into salt water, I'm thinking of the 600,000 elements of slavery, the people of slavery? Yeah? Anybody? Well, so you take this, like, does this remind you of, like, backbreaking
salt
labor?
For celery, 600,000
strings of celery, right? Get stuck in my teeth for so long, right? So maybe it's that long, 600,000 minutes of the, okay? So 600,000 shishim perach, right? So when we dip it, we take the hardship and we dip into hardship. Right? Because celery is not bad. I mean, I have potatoes. It's really not bad. Right?
It's good.
Yeah. Potatoes,
yeah. It's like a snack.
I also like the celery.
Yeah.
The salt,
but they're like cooked.
Huh?
The celery.
Yeah.
The
salt. It's good, right? You're a little refreshing to you, yeah?
They're boiled.
Boiled potatoes, yeah.
Not crunchy.
It's a boiled potato.
It's like a hard mashed potato.
It's called a cooked potato. It's nothing else. It's nothing. But what is the idea? The idea behind it is, by the way, you know that the whole idea, we don't even eat less than a kazai, so we don't have enough. So really, 10 minutes later, we can have another one.
True, because then it's not a
kazai. 10 minutes later, you can have another one. Not crazy.
We do that.
Like every 10 minutes or like every 2 minutes? Maybe you should expand it to a minimum of 4 minutes.
Have you guys dipped the potato in the salt water?
Of course.
How should I know them?
I don't know.
Of course. What else do you do? Of course.
My mom likes parsley.
All right, so some people do. I know some people, they have like a three-tiered sandwich. They do a parsley, potato, celery, but like really, it's less than a kazai. It's a problem. You're supposed to eat less than a kazai because then you have a question of making an after bracha and you wouldn't want to add another bracha into it. Because they say that based on the Gemara or whatever, that really that, I spoke about this in Shul, but like the idea is that eating matzah is supposed to be like this marriage that you have, Klal Yisrael's marriage, and really up to matzah is Sheva Brachos, 7 blessings that you have till you actually get up to eating matzah, right?
Why is it the reverse order though?
Why is it the reverse order? It's the same way at a wedding. You have Sheva Brachos,
oh, there's before?
And then the husband and wife are able to be unified. Sheva Brachos under the chuppah, right? So there's a whole association. That's maybe not having the Alamichdia, because why not just make an Alamichdia? No, the reason why we don't make an amichah is because we want the hadamah to go on the on the mar. That's also this other idea. That's also this other idea. We don't want to interfere with it. Yeah. So we usually you take the potato or parsley or celery and you dip it in the salt water as a sign of freedom. Even though salt water is a sign of slavery because it's salty, I still don't know, but whatever.
Slaves had a lot of salt.
Probably because of the sweat. That's the truth. Because they had to sweat and tears, right? And I'm saying that the sweat was like a lot of, because tears are salty, yeah? Right? I mean, I'm saying it's a question because, you know, I don't know. But that's generally what we say. So we dip it into the salt water, but dipping into salt water is actually a representation of freedom. Right? This we know that on the Manashtana we ask, you know, why on all of the nights, what do we, on other nights we, afilu pam achas, right? You don't even dip once. And now we do shtei pamim, right? So the idea is that the dipping is supposed to be a sign of ultimately freedom. So you'll note that here we're dipping as a sign of freedom, even though it represents slavery. And which we said in the past, the whole idea of karpas is the dipping of Yosef's cloak in the blood, right? Because that's what brought us into slavery. So here, when we dip it, the dipping is a sign of freedom.
Why? You
What?
Think of all the sausage you've
Only a few that I copied.
That's
right?
California.
That's how I wrote over here, right? Since dipping is a minig of free people, think of all the sauce you get at Schnitzli, right? Okay, but when it comes to charoset, so what is charoset? Charoset is supposed to represent a sense of slavery. Okay? The dipping of karpa is supposed to represent the freedom, but the dipping of charoset is supposed to represent slavery, because the mortar, the bricks, the straw. But the name of charoset is, rearrange the letters, and you have Samach Cheirut, 600,000 people who became free. So karpas is slavery, charoset is freedom. Right? Now why is this important? It's important because later on I'm going to explain to you, it's actually going to be at number 19, I think it is. Let's just see if I can turn my page. We're going to see in number 19, a relation to that, so you'll just put a mark over here by 3, and that's going to take us to 19 about having two hollow. So that number 3 was quoted from the Sefer V'chor LaZahav. So now, another idea, also seen that, is that Karpas is that many Haggadahs do not have Moshe Rabbeinu's name mentioned. Now, I don't know if you have Moshe Rabbeinu's name mentioned in your Haggadah. Growing up, we always had it mentioned. It's mentioned once. Where is it mentioned? Vayaminu ba'Hashem of Moshe Avdo. We actually recite the paragraph before Az Yashir that says Vayaminu ba'Hashem, and we believe in Hashem and Moshe Avdo. But many commentaries say that they didn't actually have it in their Haggadahs. It actually cut off the pasuk midway, and it didn't actually have Moshe's name specifically. One is to show the humility that Moshe's name is not mentioned, that Moshe doesn't want to take credit for taking the Jewish people out of Mitzrayim. Also, that we shouldn't actually think that it was Moshe, you know, and people are going to worship Moshe. I just saw in Shoftim, I was reading a comic book on Shoftim, and it goes over the story of Gideon. And the story of Gideon is that even though he came from, I think he came from the tribe of Ephraim or Manasseh. Either way, he was able to, Hashem spoke through him, he wiped out whoever was Amalek, and he wiped out, I think it was Ammon. And nobody wanted to join up with him, any of his forces. At the end, he made an ephod. He made an ephod out of all the gold nose rings that he collected from the Jews who collected it from all the spoils. And he made an ephod to signify this was Gideon's ephod. And when he made this ephod, there was peace in the land for 40 years. It's like most of the psukim and shoftim go on. Peace in the land for 40 years. But after he died, the people started worshiping the ephod, which is almost ridiculous. But we don't understand how this Avodah Zarah thing works. But people are worshipping the Ephod. So here Moshe Rabbeinu is like, take me out. Right? Emcha Misifri, take me out of the Haggadah. I don't want to be there. So in many Haggadahs, Moshe Rabbeinu's name is not actually mentioned. However, why are we mentioning it over here? The Chida says Moshe's name is mentioned twice. Where? Once by the end of Nirtza. The Gematria of Nirtza is Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe, 345. But also at the words by Karpas, it's also mentioned. Why? Because the words Pri Ha'adama is the Gematria, 345, also that of Moshe, meaning Moshe is both at the beginning and at the end, not just at your Seder beginning and end, but also beginning of exile and redemption, and also at the end of it as well. Okay, so again, the Gematria of of Pri Ha'adama is 345. Next, number five. How are we doing so far? Anybody, did I get anybody any of it? Are you doing the math? You didn't get that math yet?
No, it just seems so strange.
Strange,
that
yeah?
Moshe is represented by, like...
Why is he represented by Karpas?
It's random.
It's just interesting. I mean, like the Afka, the Chida was trying to find... I don't
but
know,
it seems like that Chida is definitely referring to the end of Nirtza. Why is it the Sefer that I saw? I don't know if it's quoting it. The Chida said that, but he also says that it's again. Why again? Good question. Why would Moshe be at Karpas? What's he doing at Karpas over here? Good question.
But like, couldn't there be other words that also are 345?
Yeah,
not these.
For sure. But for some reason, they're trying to find a remez to Moshe if he's not in the Haggadah. He's a major role within Geula Mitzrayim. So why isn't he here? Should be here in the whole Geula, the whole experience. Like every pasuk, every chapter in Shmos is all about Moshe Rabbeinu doing everything, the Malkus and everything. And you're taking him out of the whole thing over here. So he's here, but he's hinted. He's here
and he's hinted.
Yeah, let's hear your answer.
Well, I don't know if it's an answer. It's just an idea that I feel like when we're introduced to Moshe Rabbeinu first in Shmos, other than the whole story of Yochabed and the Bas and everything else like that, but was when he went out because he noticed. And he started beating up on the intense slavery. He didn't go out initially when the Jews were first starting to work for Paro. Like, I feel like when you start hearing the whole story of the Gula and everything, is when he goes out when they're involved in the slavery.
When they're already in slavery.
Yeah, and then I feel like Karpas is the first introduction
to slavery itself.
In between the whole Seder and everything.
All right, could be. Very nice. Very nice. Okay, number five over here. Yachatz, famous idea from Rosh Schwab. When we do yachatz, you hide the bigger matzah. Okay? At our Seder, we instituted that we get people to vote to see which is going to become the bigger half. They always think that I'm cheating. But, you know, it's very hard to take these big round matzahs and to break them in half. It's just not easy, yeah? Rashad says we hide the bigger matzah. This we know, we hide the bigger matzah. When you break the matzah, when breaking the matzah and hiding the bigger one, Rashad's father said, you should tell the children that the small piece which stays at the Seder is only what we see. In life, we can be tempted to focus on things that we do not have or the things that go wrong. But what is going correct or right in our life is always much greater. It's just hidden and saved for later. By the end of the Seder, when you come to a level of Emunah, then we can see it and locate it. Rosh Shlomo Einhorn added to this idea, children generally aren't bitter like some adults can be. They usually see the good much more than many adults who lose the childlike ability to just be happy. And it's therefore the children who find the Afikoman for us to remind us that there is a lot of good in our lives. We just have to be able to see it and find it. I didn't print this one out, did I? I should have a safer. No, I didn't print it out. I'll just mention it here briefly, or actually we'll skip it for now, and we'll try to give you another and one to cover for 20. I said it was supposed to be 20, yeah?
You're saving one for later. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Okay, Yachatz. The Magen Avraham mentions the idea. This is interesting. I didn't get a chance to call my father to ask this question. But the Magen Avraham mentions the idea that we put away the larger half of the matzah. We know Sephardim, you guys carry the matzah over your backs, yeah? Is that what you do?
I heard that the Syrian custom.
Oh, only Syrians do that? They carry it over their backs?
The rabbi that I work with was saying that, like, it's like a Syrian.
It's only Syrian, okay.
They carried
it over their backs. Okay, so that's the famous thing that they carried over their backs. But here, the Magen Avraham is saying that it's wrapped in a cloth, then hidden away to commemorate the idea of Misha'arotam, Tzurot B'Simlotam Al Shechmam. Misha'arotam, Tzurot B'Simlotam Al Shechmam is that they gathered this together, and Al Shechmam is on their shoulders, but B'Simlotam is in their clothing. So I said, I always wonder if that's why my father, and I just asked somebody else, goes, oh yeah, my father did the same thing. Whenever we take the afikomen, first thing we do is we stick it in over here. We wear a kittel. I don't know if you wear a kittel. Sephardim kittel? No? Right? Okay. You're not Sephardi. But we put it in here and then walk around to try to hide it. We hide it. You guys steal it? Hmm? What do you do with the afikomen?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Mm-hmm.
What?
I hide it.
You kids hide it.
I hide it too.
The adults hide it.
I hide it too.
You hide it? Is that out of laziness or just...
No, like the kids, like as when we were growing up, we would always hide it.
The kids always hide and the parents have to find it, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a whole debate, right? A whole debate who does what. And the kids, because there's a concept called stealing the afikomen. Why do you want to steal the afikomen? It's a whole question. Why should you steal the afikomen? So we have it that we hide it and the kids have to go find it. Some people have it that the kids actually try to have to go steal it, which is a weird question. Why are we teaching kids to steal? Right? It's the famous question. Some of the answers, the significance of this idea of Yaakov stealing the brachos, that it's something for ultimate geula, and they actually have this idea, because that's what the afikomen represents, the ultimate geula of everything, the culmination over here. So here's the idea that tzuros besimlo, some stuck in their clothing, and perhaps this is why people have the minhag to actually stick it in their clothing before they actually go ahead and hide it. number 8, Arba Banim. The Haggadah V'tahir Libeinu asked the question, why did Avram and Yitzchak both have to have children who are wicked? Why did they have to experience such pain and agony? The reason is to be a limud zuchut on the Jewish people, that Hashem should have mercy on us in light of these wicked people. Even Avram and Yitzchak had children who went off the derech. Shlomo Kluger says something similar. The reason that Hashem, misspelling, waited for us to get to the 49th level of Tumah so that nobody would make the mistake of thinking that the reason we got out was because of some specific merit that we had. It was not due to any specific merit or choice, but rather because of who we were, not in fact what we did. And therefore, this idea that even Avram Yitzchak had kids with difficulties, maybe they were learning disabled, I don't know, but they had kids that were off the derech, and therefore for us, it's to look at the opportunity in our children that they all have zechuyos, they all have merits, and not that they're good the way they are. Okay? Number 9, the Tolna Rebbe says on the Arba Banim, that why is a Chacham and Rasha? The opposite of Chacham is a Tipesh, right? Or someone who's a fool. Why is this paralleling the wise son? Why is that the wicked son? So he explains, we see from here that the wickedness is actually considered stupidity. That is foolishness. Rasha is a fool. Why? It's acting unintelligently. If you want to be happy and productive and reach your goals, being a Rasha is absolutely a terrible choice. Wickedness comes from looking at life incorrectly. That last line is not mine. I'm not quoting it. Next. We did quote this idea in the other class of Matra Begnus of Mitchila Ovdi Avodah Zarah. So if I brought it here, we'll just quote it. We said that why is it that the Gemara requires us that we should mention all the negative things that we had first of Ovdi Avodah Zarah? If you remember this from the pages a couple of weeks ago, we said that in fact the reason why we do it was not to show the negativity of the Jewish people, but that Avraham Avinu, who is the source of all of Judaism for all of us, is showing that he was able to break free and he was able to be the one to fight against the tide and bring us up with this great power of what it actually means to be a Yid. So Maschil B'Gnus is, although it looks like a negative thing, in fact, it's a positive experience of the Jewish people come from Avraham Avinu, who's able to go against the tide. That was number 10. That's Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah. Next, number 11, Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah. The Rav Melech Biderman, his Agadah Be'erach Chaim, he says, even though we need to do a cheshbon nefesh and introspect about our actions, it's not something that we should actually harp on. If you do, it leads to laxity and depression. If you feel so bad that you're a failure in all the things that you do. The Slonim Rebbe writes on this idea, meaning based on this idea, he says, Slonim Rebbe says, Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah. Mitchila, if I'm going to be focused on my sins from the beginning, it's a form of Avodah Zarah. Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah. If you're always stuck on your wrongdoings, then you're like an Ovdei Avodah Zarah. But achshav kirvenu hamakom, kirvenu, what is it? Kirvenu ha makom lavodaso, right? But achshav, if someone works on himself on the achshav, on his present and on his future, then he'll be able to be kirvenu hamakom lavodaso, who get closer to Hashem. But if you're stuck in a mitchila, oh, I didn't do this right, I'm always a failure at this, then you're going to be considered like an ovdei avodah zarah. But if you work in the world of achshav, you'll be able to get kirvenu hamakom lavodas, you'll be able to get close to Hashem and to be able to serve Him. Number 12, vayarenu osanu. The Egyptians, they cause us terrible pain. This is part of Maggid, of course. This phrase is usually translated as meaning that the Egyptians mistreated us. Grammatically, however, if that were the message, the verse should more properly have stated, Vayarei aleinu. What is aleinu, to us? What is osanu? As phrased here, the more correct translation would seem to be that the Egyptians thought of us as evil. They assigned bad attributes to us, depicted us as terrible people, and attributed negative qualities to us. Sounds like the world we live in today. Sounds like what everybody's saying about the Jewish people and Israel and everything else. We're awful people, right? They assigned bad attributes to us. Thus, we read in the verse from Shemos, Paro accused the Jews of disloyalty, of plotting a revolution, of nefarious scheming. Right? If you remember, that's what it says, that Paro says we have to do something about it because they're going to go and join up against our enemies and do these things. The Egyptians thus besmirched, again, these are the words of Rav Soloveitchik, they besmirched the reputation and good name that the Jews had previously enjoyed. So it's not just simply about slavery here. Here, they made us look like bad people. They made us look into like terrible people. And that's already part of exile that we go through. We can certainly apply this in our daily life over here. Number 13. Okay, look at that. I'm at 31 minutes. 13. I have more time. There was, of course, no logical basis for... Oh, no, actually, this is not 13. Sorry, that was a mistake. Now I owe you two. Okay, 13. That was actually a continuation of that paragraph. There was, of course, no logical basis for such accusations. The Jews had done nothing wrong. There's no indication anywhere that they were anything but model citizens in their adopted land, contributing to the country's general development. But in seeking to isolate and ultimately persecute them, Paro played on many people's natural fear of those who are just not like them, portraying the Jews as the other and different, as being aliens, outsiders, and thus a threat to be feared. In this way, Paro was able to get widespread support from his Egyptian countrymen for his campaign to enslave the Jews. This, of course, is paradigmatic of classic anti-Semitism throughout the ages. Jews can live comfortably and productively in the land for many years, develop great and unswerving loyalty towards it. We work hard and sacrifice, but they are always in danger of an enemy who will arise, as has indeed happened in so many occasions in history, who will ignore their valuable contributions, paint them as dangerous and undermining outsiders looking for power and control, and create mistrust. This has been the experience for the Jew in exile for centuries. Oh, sorry, that was still part of number 12. Number 14, the easy one, because we did it a couple weeks ago, and that is Ani v'lo Malach. That Rav Dessa here, I think he's quoting from the Arizal. No, he's quoting from the Zohar HaKadosh. That when Hashem says, I'm going to go down there and send you with nobody else. So this is what we said, the quoting from Rav Dessa over here. That Hashem had to bring the Geula himself. Ki lo haya efshel malach likanes. Why? Because a malach would not possibly be able to enter Mitzrayim because the Tumah was so powerful. The Kedusha of a Malach would have even been destroyed in Mitzrayim as well. Okay? We also said from Rav Dessler that the reason why Hashem had to do it himself, because it would have been anybody else, no one would have had any belief of that. They would have not even believed a Malach. They were so stooped in their Avodah Zarah. They need clear revelation to take them out of Mitzrayim. And this perhaps what we'll see in our days as well, when Geula will come, those people that do not believe in Hashem at all, they will actually see it with open eyes and open miracles. Next, the 10 plagues. I'm only taking ones. I have three ideas from frogs out of this world. Okay? That's it. I don't have anything else for you, just frogs. 10 plagues. Maybe, whatever. 10 plagues, and we're taking frogs over here. The Das of Canaan and the Moshe of Canaan, which are known as the Balei Hatosos, they're the ones that write this idea. In Shmos, it says, I don't even bring it. Okay, in the Chumash, it tells us that when the... It's okay, we'll just kind of wing it. In Shmos, we'll just hop to it, right? In Shmos, it says, give me chumash. I need the chumash. There's two psukim that are going to relate to what Hashem actually commands. I did quote two of them over here. In Parak Zion, it says, "Vesharetz hayor tzvardim va'alu v'meitacha v'chad meshkacha mitasecha." The yor, the river, is going to be full of frogs. Thank you. Va'alu, and they're going to come. Ubav v'meitacha, they're going to come into your homes, and chad meshkacha, in your sleeping quarters, amitasecha, on your beds, uvaveit avadecha, and in your slaves' places, uvamecha, and in your nation, uvatanurecha, and in your ovens. Mish arosecha, and lastly, mish arosecha, which I don't know what that actually means, is right here, 728. Mish arosecha, also known as the. Anyone know what the word mish arosecha is known for? Okay, the word itself actually means your kneading bowls. Mish arosecha. The claim to fame of the word mish arosecha is the longest word in the Torah. Okay?
Really?
V'mish arosecha is the longest word in Torah. You can see that in 16b over there. Count those letters up. Longest word in Torah. Yeah? So, why mixing bowls is like mentioned over here. Okay? It's like everything else. Like, think of it in English. The river is going to swarm with frogs. They will come into your palace, your bedroom, your bed, the house of your servants, of your people, your ovens, and in your kneading bowls. I never looked into that.
That's what misharotecha means?
Yeah, misharotecha, your kneading bowls. Like, first of all, what's a kneading bowl? And why do I care about a kneading bowl? I mean, I know what a kneading bowl is, where I make dough. I understand. It's like,
any commentaries on that one?
I didn't see anything on it. I just noticed it now that like this is like such a big deal.
All these comments on frogs, you saw nothing.
I know, I didn't actually look, but I brought this agada here that we can always find something on about kneading bowls. But before I go through another thing on that, let's just go over here. This is a Haggadah. Yeah, this is a Masifta Haggadah. It's pretty large.
What?
It's a Masifta Haggadah. Just keep close, like, a thousand things. let's just see over here, more Gadol. Let's not lose track. We'll just get back to it in a moment. So here, the Das of Canaan. So if you look at the Torah says that Hashem says to them, this is what's going to happen. Okay, then in Perkhes, the Pasuk actually tells us, what do you want from me? Vayomer Moshe, Leparo, Hisparo la Matay Atir. When you want these gone? Okay, Vayomer Lemachar. Tomorrow. Fine, no problem. So the pasuk says, "V'sara tzvardiim," the frogs will depart from you and from your house and from your servants and from your people, and they're only going to remain in the yor. The pasuk says, "Vayitzak Moshe v'Aaron mim Paro," and suddenly Moshe and Aaron vayitze, they left Paro, and then it says, "Vayitzak Moshe el Hashem," and Moshe cried out to Hashem. Why is he crying out to Hashem? It's only Makkah, he's actually crying out to Hashem. Some of the commentaries say he cried out to Hashem because it was so noisy. And the plague of frogs made it that it was actually super noisy. And that's why he had to yell in order to daven to Hashem. Okay, what that means, I don't know. But he cried out to Hashem. Al dvar tzardim, on account of the frogs that he gave to Paro. And now you look at the pasuk, which now you'll see over here, which I quoted... No, I didn't quote that pasuk over there. In Perek Ches, in pasuk 9, Tes, it says, Vayas Hashem kedvar Moshe, and Hashem did like Moshe says, Vayimusa tzvardim. The frogs died. Min habatim, from the homes. Min hachatzerot, from the courtyards. Min hasadot, and from the fields. Says Das Kain, which is on your page over here, number 15. Aval osim sheba tanurim lamesu. Guess what? The frogs that went into the ovens, they did not die. Because they had bitachon in Hashem, v'nichnesu b'taner cham b'tziva Hashem, because they went into these hot ovens by the command of Hashem, and therefore, because of their bitachon, they did not actually die. Because even though it seems from the pasuk that they all died, but the pasuk doesn't say where they all died from. It just said that they died from the homes, from the fields, and from the courtyards. But those who are in the ovens seem to remain alive. This Dasakanim is from Tosos. This is the Dasakanim, the Bali Hatosos. It's the frogs in the oven didn't die. Why? Because they had bitachon in Hashem. So based on that, we go to number 6 in the Gemara. And Pesachim actually says, Tashma, Odzudarsh Todosh Yishromi. Todosh Yishromi explained the following. Ma ro Chanani Mishal v'Nazaria. Chanani Mishal v'Nazaria are known for the fact that they went into the fiery furnace. Shemas Rasman Kiddush Hashem. They gave up their life for Kiddush Hashem. Lekiv Shanesh, they went into a fiery furnace. How do they know to do this? They should just get thrown in. Nasu Kal V'Chomer, says the Gemara, they learned Mei Hatzfardim, they learned from the frogs.
Ben Chamu.
Huh? Ben Chamu, yeah? So, Uma Tzvardim, She'ein Metzuvim Akadush Hashem, frogs who are not commanded on sanctifying Hashem's name. It says, Uvo Valu Bevetecha. It says they went into the homes and they went into the ovens. Uvetanu Recha Mishara Secha. So a frog is not commanded to sanctify God's name. Emesai Misharos Mitzuyas Eitzel Tanur. When do you have mixing bowls next to an oven? Havi Omer Bishasha Tanur Cham. That's when the oven's hot. That's why your mixing bowls are mentioned here. Anu Shemetsu Makdush Hashem. You think they just went into ovens before it was on? No, the ovens have to have been on. We, says Chanan Mishal Nazari, who are commanded to sanctify God's name, al achas kama v'kama, we too are going to sanctify Hashem's name. Okay? So that can count for me as number 13, that one I skipped, because that's enough of a vort in itself, the Gemara. Gemara says that Chanani Mishal Nazari learned from the frogs that they gave up their life even though they weren't commanded on it. We who are commanded to give up our life for Kiddush Hashem, we're going in the oven also. That's what they did. So now, based on this, we have a question. How is this a Kal V'Chomer? Okay, this is the Vilna Gaon's answer over here. How is this a Kal V'Chomer? They don't have a mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem. And so they jumped into fire. We do have the mitzvah. Wait a minute. What do you mean they don't have a mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem? They were commanded to, and that was the pasuk I read to you before. Hashem says, I'm going to send out frogs, and they're going to go into your homes, into your beds, and into your ovens. So they're commanded to go into the ovens. So how can you tell me they're not commanded to throw themselves in the ovens? The Vilna Gaon answers, when he was a child, although they were commanded, but that specific frog was not told to go into the oven. They just said, frogs, some of you on the beds, some of you in the mixing bowls, and some in the ovens. So some of the frogs said, I'll do it. I'm in. I'm in for this one. Those frogs had free will. They jumped into the ovens. And they died on Kiddush Hashem. Unbelievable. Okay, you think it's funny.
But just said that the frogs in the ovens didn't die because they trusted in Hashem. The way that they were.
Because they were not Mitzvah Yosef. Because Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah said, I learned a Kal V'Chomer.
I'm saying that they didn't die.
Ah, very good, right? That's a different view, yeah? No, they were giving up their life on Kiddush Hashem. And they were saved. So to Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah also thought, I'll be saved also. Because I learned from frogs. If they're going to do it, then I can do it also. Okay? So in fact, they were really not commanded directly. And therefore, why it is actually considered a good Kal V'Chomer. Now, you have a printout over here. This is going to be a little bit tough. But we're going to give it a shot. Okay? You have this Hebrew printout that I gave you of the Tzidkas HaTzadik, or Tzadik HaKohen of Lublin. So we're going to read from the bottom side because it's easier to read it from. It flows easier. But it starts over here all the way on the right side bottom. Uvizohar Parshas Pinchas. Okay, you see that? Uvizohar Parshas Pinchas. The bottom is just like an explanation of the top because the top is his words. The bottom is really more they expanded to explain. Okay, so we'll do my best over here. Help me out. Okay? hopefully it's easier than the last one, that first one you read that you didn't understand, yeah? Zohar Pinchas, Perek Shira. Also, we say that Svardeya Amar LeDavid. In Perek Shir it says, and some of you say Perek Shir like every day, so you know what the frog says, yeah? What does the frog say? Very good. The frog, actually, its job is to keep talking. That's its job. And actually, its job is just keep making noise. And it's the Perek Shir, it says, Svardeya Amar LeDavid Shim Mekalesis Yom V'Layla Hashem. Bli Hefsek. I praise Hashem day and night without stopping. I just keep croaking all the time. Why is it when some person dies, they say he croaked? I don't get it. Croaking just is continuous. right?
That's a very good question.
Right? You say someone croaked. No, the frogs croak all day and night. They don't stop. So it doesn't bother any of you here, okay? Except one of you. You understand? A frog says, I praise Hashem all day without hefsek because I make noise all day. His noise is praising Hashem. When someone dies in English, we say, oh man, he croaked.
Maybe
the point is not that. Because
it's the sound. It sounds like a croak.
That's
what they're referring to.
As the sound refers to croak.
I have a really beautiful word on this. Once they pass away, then you sing Hashem Shabbat all day, just like the frog. So they croak.
Could be. Okay.
But I don't think that's what it
was. Probably not. Yeah, I'm guessing not. Either way, so here. The Zohar explains that the Tzvardeim oat? I don't know. Tzvardeim. Thank you. That was weird. Okay.
That was extra funny.
Sorry, that was bad. The Tzvardeim, they praise Hashem day and night without stopping. V'ashen kol ha'naim, even though their sounds are not pleasing to the ears, like birds chirping are more pleasing. Nechshav kashir v'shevach, it's still considered to be a song. Two lines on the bottom there. V'hainu. Dema shetzavachos bakola, the fact that the frog is screaming out, kavan dekol lemanehu, that the whole idea of the all the croaks or the croaking that this frog makes is all for the sake of Hashem. V'hainu shebaram lekiluso, next paragraph over, right? If you're in the middle, right? They were created to praise Hashem. And that's their job, to praise Hashem through these sounds that they're actually making. Hare pulasa tmidis lekilos Hashem yizbarach. If that's what their job is, then ultimately their job of the tzvardeis kilos Hashem yizbarach is to praise Hashem day and night. Why? Because they were created in the way what their teva actually is, and therefore it's a mamalas ritzono. I'll pause and give you that other idea, my favorite idea that I saw, but I shared with you before, on frogs. That we know that the Gemara says that, and Rashi quotes it, that it says the word tzvardeya. This would be like the fifth idea in frogs, right? It says the idea of tzvardeya, was it one frog or many frogs? So Rashi says it was one frog. Remember this from last year? You should get it, yeah? It was one frog, but then the Egyptians came and they hit it, and then it spit out more frogs. Yeah?
Yeah.
It's Rashi quoted. You remember the idea? Yeah? Remember the idea? So, what does it mean they spit out more frogs? So, many years ago, I was in the Discovery Center in Silmar, right? And they had an exhibit on frogs. And you can look it up yourselves. They had an exhibit on frogs, and they had a frog called the Darwin frog. I think it was from Northern Africa, I'm not sure. But what it does is, after the eggs become fertilized, the frog stores them in its sack, in its mouth. Remember this, yeah? Stores them in its sack, in its mouth, and when ready, it spits them out, and other frogs actually come out. I was like, whoa. That's a Rashi. That's a Rashi. We're like, what do you mean that's what's happening over here? Spitting out frogs? Yeah, spat out frogs. Okay, anyway. So that was at the Discovery Cube, Discovery Center, one of the two. You can look it up, Darwin Frog. So now, they're doing the will of Hashem. Continuing on, therefore, a person needs to learn from them, from the frogs. As the Gemara we just read to you, Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, they learned the Kav HaChomer from the frogs. Even though frogs have no free will. So how can you learn a Kav HaChomer from something that has no free will? Okay, you can actually say, they did this, so we should also do this. Nonetheless, we learn from them. Why? Sometimes Mesiras Nefesh means to do things that are against nature. The gam kishai ayidei bitel hadavarhu, even if it means that it's going to cease the existence of this particular thing in its natural order. It will end it entirely. So what they learned from the frogs, shere kach ra'inu, what Hashem established within the frogs of Egypt, the kishayesh, next paragraph over, next page, the kishayesh kiddush Hashem b'davar, whenever there's the concept of sanctifying Hashem's name, heim paalim es pulasim, the mesiras nafshim. They, the frogs, do whatever they're supposed to do if it's needed for mesiras nefesh. Even if it means they're going to be destroyed, And that by therefore by going in the ovens, it means I'm still doing teva. I'm going to do what I need to do, even if it means actually being destroyed. Hagam b'teva shel kol habruim. Even though naturally it's normal for all creatures to run away from danger, but when there's the opportunity for Kiddush Hashem, all of nature can change. And a person can give up their life, or an animal can give up their life if it's for the sake of Kiddush Hashem. And from this, he says, you learn that people who have free will, b'nei b'chira gam king, lishmar teguf, we all try to guard our bodies, and we try to run away from danger, lishvos m'pilasov l'noach, right? Gam mitzvah Hashem, dugmas heim, in a similar vein. What does that mean? B'pulasam tivos, we try to do Hashem's will, but whenever, and we want to run away from danger, like most, anyone who wants to die doesn't actually, is not living the life of free will. They're giving up, or they're in a place where they're not in their mental capacity, appropriate mental capacity. But whenever there's Kiddush Hashem, a person has to be willing to give up Mesiris Nefesh for that. As Chazal tells, and from a pasuk from Eo, fine. And now he learns the following, and this is probably the kicker for this one over here. There's a Gemara that tells us, had the Torah not been given, we would have been able to learn tzniut from a cat. Gezel, stealing, from an ant. A rayot, from a yonah, from a dove. And therefore he says, sha'anachnu b'pulasenu ha'bechirit l'medin mehem. The idea of free will and having free choice and yet giving it up for the sake of Mesiris Nefesh, you can learn from a frog. That's the key. This idea you can actually learn from a frog. How do we have the ability to give up free will? So it's saying, when the Gemara is saying, Hanani, Mishael, and Azar, they took a Kal V'chomer, it means frogs are the ones who taught us the idea of Mesiris Nefesh. That's the key.
So why is that not in Pelek Shiva then? Why is that not in Pelek Shiva then?
Because they say they're Mekales Yom Yom. That's their line. Because Perek Shir is all about how they sing the songs of Hashem. Mm-hmm. And they praise Hashem. Yeah. And here he's saying that this is what it is. Okay. So that's, how many is that on frogs? One, two, three, four on frogs. All right? Okay. Let's close up over here. Shroch HaMatcha, the Rebbe of Sadigur says that we open the door when you open the door for Shroch HaMatcha. Just a friendly reminder for those of you who forgot, save your wine from your Dam Tzvardeya. Okay? Save your wine. You put on your bad neighbors that you want to move. Right? I did in the front of their house.
You know, but like not on the person.
No, not on the person. I don't think it's a good idea. But that's save your wine so you can actually use it. Shira's still working on, she got half the house taken care of, working on the rest
it's
of the house.
It's really sad, actually. Okay. People died.
Right.
I don't want to do it again. The house is a huge neighbor. Two people died in the house.
But don't forget, there's like 12 people living in that house, it's or 15 true. People. It's like 17 families living in that house. It's not even like, you know. Okay, either way. So the Rabbi of Sadegur says that we open the door, we say, Shvoch HaMatcha al HaGoyim. This is right next to Hallel where we praise Hashem. Why? The only way you can stand up against your enemy as such a small person is when you first learn to appreciate and acknowledge where the source of your strength comes from. The moment you separate that, it goes away. The moment Shimshon's hair was cut, which was his agreement with HaKadosh Baruch, he became weak. He only got it back when he said, I know it all comes from you. So this juxtaposition tells us that our strength, our power, our fortitude only focuses properly when we learn to appreciate Hashem in our lives and never forget that idea. 19 or 18, whatever up to. Why two hallels? The Vilna Gaon says that we have two hallels, one before the meal, one after the meal. Are we familiar with why the two hallels? So the Vilna Gaon gives you a major yesod. The major yesod is, and I told you this is going to take us back to number 3. The major yesod is that before the Seuda, it's all about Golos. It's all about reliving Exodus. It's all about going through the hardships of what it was all about. After the Seuda, it's all about the future. It's all about praising Hashem for all the things that are going to be. That's why the first half of Hallel is all talking about Mitzrayim, things that are going on. Where the second half of Hallel, we drop the idea of Mitzrayim, we actually talk about other things. It's really all talking about the future. So we mentioned to you in number three that we had karpas and charoset for two different things. The karpas represented the exile, the hardships, and yet charoset is actually going to be transformed. Where's number three over here? That represents the charos, because when is that charoset being eaten? It's being eaten at the meal. At the meal is a transformation. That's why the matzah also did the same thing. The matzah was lachma anya. It was poor man's bread. You spoke about it. And then you ate it. You eat it. How do you eat it? You have to be leaning. Why? Because when you're eating the matzah, it's free. When you're talking about matzah, it's sadness. It's all about slavery. First half of the meal is all about the hardships. Second half of the meal is all about the praise. And it's actually a prayer for the future, says the Vilna Gaon. That's why one of the first things you're going to do is say Shvot Chamad Chal HaGayim. It's talking about the future of what Hashem, I want you to actually go through. I want you to experience. You know, many people, they realize, like reform, conservative, people are unaffiliated. They sit at the Seder till the meal. And then once the meal's over, they leave. But that's the key. The key is the second half, which is about our future, is a prayer for the future. That's what it's all about. And too many people walk out from that point because they ate, but they missed the whole point. It's actually all about the future. That's the two hollows you have that. and that's why it's called Karpas and Charoset are two different experiences. They're actually going to be, the Cherus is going to be by Charoset now, even though it's a sad experience, really ultimately is the freedom. Last we're going to give you over here, or if I have maybe one more, but we have the Vilna Gaon, which is the last page that's in English here. We're going to go through part of this Vilna Gaon. And this is the Vilna Gaon's famous thing on Chag Gadya. what was that question you had on frogs before? I wanted to look up. What was it?
The kneading bowls.
Oh, the kneading bowls, yeah. So we said that, okay, the Gemara said the kneading bowls were needed because it was necessary. The teacher said the idea that the bowls are going to be near hot ovens, yeah? Fine. So let's do the Chag Gadya, the last piece over here, Chag Gadya. Chag Gadya, Chag Gadya, the Zav and Abba. So this is a famous idea from the Vilna Gaon, but you have to, I've printed it, A, because I didn't have time to type it because it's so long, and B, because you need to see it in text, even though it's not his words, this is the English. One kid. Okay, you get it? Ready for this? Fundamental doctrine. Vilna Gaon writes, this is a yesod, this is an important yesod. You know this Vilna Gaon? This is the 10%, if you know this one, right? How did I do so far on the others?
Really okay, yeah? One.
Huh? Which one do you know?
I don't remember.
I already forgot. Huh? I said, you might know whatever I'm quoting to.
10%.
That was my guess. Oh. I guess it's 10%. Not because it's like Bittel Bashish and Rabbi. You know? So, Chag Gadya, Chag Gadya. It's a fundamental doctrine that any goodness that befalls us, be it in this world or the next, is part of the legacy bestowed upon us by our forefathers. Yitzchak bless Yaakov. In plain English, all bracha that we have within this world, any goodness comes from the bracha that Yaakov got from Yitzchak. Okay? What was that bracha he got from Yitzchak? It's going to be from the two gedi izim that his mother made him prepare. Were it not for these brachos, we would have nothing. All would have gone to Esav. I mean, we would have spiritual experiences, but any pleasures of this world, any physical benefits we would have, initially it was supposed to be two brothers. Esav gets Olam Hazeh, Yaakov gets Olam Haba. Okay? But only because of these brachas we have. The blessings are brought about through two goats. Regarding the verse in Bereishis, take for me, Kachli Shtegdi Izim, two young goats, Chazal have said, they're good. What does it mean, too good? What does it mean, Gdi Izim Tovim? It means good for you and good for your children. What does it mean, good for you, good for your children? They're good for you in that you get brachos through these things. They're good for your children, they will be Zocha to bring two goats to atone for them on Yom Kippur, Sar Lashem, Sar Lazazel. So the two goats that the Zohar says that time I think was Pesach. I think the Zohar says it was Pesach because when he brought the two goats, one was Korban Pesach and one was the Korban Chagiga that he brought. But these are going to reference the two goats that they parallel each other to the goats that Yaakov brought Yitzchak. Just as one of these goats of Yom Kippur comes to atone for the and the other comes to counteract the Satan, so he should not raise the accusation against us, so too are the goats of Yaakov. Now, this is an important line over here. It is known that our father Yaakov passed on the blessings to his son Yosef as well as the birthright to the firstborn. How do we know this? It's because of the fact that in the brachos that he gave to his sons, the only bracha that has the word bracha in it is the bracha given over to Yosef. That is his bracha over here. Let's read it in Hebrew. But the bracha given over to Yosef is, like, for example, how do we know? These are the brachos. Remember, it says like this. Where is it? Ruvain, Bechori Ata, Kochiv Rosh Hashanah, Yeser Seis V'Yeser Eiv. Us, right? You're my strength, my initial vigor, foremost in rank, and foremost in power. Water like impetuosity. You cannot be foremost because you mounted your father's bed, and then you desecrated and ascended my couch. Whatever means, notice over there, Pachas Kamayim. There's no word bracha in it until you get up to Yosef, which is in Pasuk Chaf Vav. And when you get up to Yosef in Pasuk Chaf Vav, it says, Berchot Avicha Gavru al Berchot Horai. The blessings of your father surpassed the blessing of my parents to the endless bounds of the world's hills. What is that referring to? Yaakov got a bracha from Yitzchak, the one that he stole, and he gave that bracha over to Yosef. However, it is also known that the brothers of Yosef were overcome by jealousy, and they sold Yosef to Egypt to nullify his possession of the blessings and the birthright. Which meant what? What does that mean? Practically, it means when they sold him, now the brachos that were supposed to come to the Jewish people are going to go away. Which is why we had to go to slavery. We had to go into exile because we lost the power of goodness within the world. Which led us, our ancestors, into Egypt. Furthermore, the Torah says, take in your hand the staff which you will perform the signs, the telling over to Moshe Rabbeinu, indicating the signs were brought about through the staff. The clouds of glory that accompanied the Jews in the desert and all the goodness that was all manifest in the base of Mikdash are also associated with the staff. But that's later on, so I don't know why he's bringing it up over here. But fine. So I don't know why that is actually quoted here. But the first piece that we're looking over here is that Chad Gadya is really about these two Gedi'ism. That's why you'll notice it says Chad Gadya, Chad Gadya. Why did it say it twice? Shouldn't it have said Shnei Gedi'im? Shnei Gedim once. Chad Gadi, Chad Gadya. So it's a reference to two different things. Many commentators discuss the idea that it's Olam Hazeh, Olam Haba. It's Esav and Yaakov. It's getting both brachos is what he actually has. He's actually able to get both these things over here. So that's actually referring to all the brachos that he's getting from Esav. Just notice here in the bottom of your Esav, Esav is also referred to as a goat as well. Why? I didn't even know this was an English word. But Esav is referred to here as an Ish Sa'ir. Of course, how do you say Sa'ir in English? Hirsute. Have you heard that word before?
Never.
Me neither. Never heard it before, yeah? But it means Ish Sa'ir is a hairy man. Sa'ir is Sa'ir Ezim, is a goat. The Gemara in Shabbos relates that Rabbi Zeir once asked Rabbi Yehuda why goats walk at the front of the herd ahead of sheep. Rabbi Yehuda answered, just as in the natural cycle of time, night precedes day, so to goats, the darker of the two animals precede the lighter sheep. What? Rabbi Zera's question can be interpreted as referring to the fact that Esav was born before Yaakov. In his answer, Rabbi Yehuda is saying that this need not be an indication of any aspect of superiority on Esav's part. On the contrary, the peel which is discarded appears before the fruit. You get that? So that's what he's asking this question about Golos. He's asking this question about Yaakov and Esav over here. No, this is the end. So that's why let's just see if anything else. There's more in this idea. This is just the introduction of Chad Gadya, but it goes to the whole thing to understand how ultimately the end of Chad Gadya is really Mashiach ben Yosef, Mashiach ben David, the different exiles that Jewish people are going to go through, the ultimate redemption that we're going to have. But you should walk away with the Chad Gadya to realize that Hashem is in charge of everything and that He is giving us a lot of blessings within this world. We should take those blessings and keep them on to us. And that is hopefully our 20.